Hello, I'm Hugh Rimmington. Welcome to the Roundtable. Boredom is such a dull, everyday subject, it hardly seems worth discussing. But stifle your yawns, because there's more to boredom than meets the eye. Boredom can be very bad for us. It is linked to depression, to eating disorders, and to high risk-taking, ranging from bad driving to drug abuse. But boredom, it seems, is also adaptive, which means the process of evolution has given it to us, and to some animals, because it confers some kind of natural advantage. And this is boredom's paradox. It is also linked to higher levels of creativity. In the words of A.A. Milne, put into the mouth of Winnie the Pooh, doing nothing often leads to the very best kind of something. Well, at the round table today, clinical psychologist John Eastwood. He is the director of the Boredom Lab. There is such a thing at York University in Ontario, Canada. Dr. Josepha Ross Velasco is at Harvard University, where she works in the Department of Romance Languages and Literatures. And Dr. Helen Street is from the Graduate School of Education at the University of Western Australia. Welcome to our panel today.
Hello.
Hello.
Hello there. Boredom, let's start with you. You run a lab, John Eastwood, called the Boredom Lab there in Canada. Why are you studying boredom?
Well, as you said in your introductory remarks, boredom, the more you think about it, becomes quite fascinating. It's an intriguing emotional state, and I'm very interested in studying it because it's such an open space where we can explore so many different ideas. And as a clinical psychologist, I often heard clients who were struggling with chronic depression who said to me that they also felt bored a lot. And so that got me thinking, well, is boredom different from depression, or is it part of depression? And that kind of launched me, I don't know, maybe 10 years ago or more, starting to think about boredom.
So how do you define boredom?
So I would define boredom as the uncomfortable state of being mentally unengaged. So when we're bored, our mind is not occupied. But in addition, when we're bored, we want our mind to be occupied. There's a famous quote from Tolstoy who said that boredom is the desire for desires. And that illustrates that there's a tricky problem in boredom, and that is that you have this urge to be mentally engaged, but you can't say what it is that you would like to do that's possible in the moment. And so there's an ineffectual or objectless desiring that happens.
So what are the negatives of that experience?
Well, boredom, as you said, has been associated with a host of psychosocial problems. Boredom appears to be related to overeating. Boredom is related to risk-taking. Boredom has been related to aggressive behavior and hostility towards people, especially from other social groups. And so boredom, you know, the research is really in its infancy. And so these are some of the things that we have some preliminary data on, but certainly we need to do a lot more work to more fully understand what causes boredom and what its consequences are.
Well, let's in a moment get onto the upsides of boredom, if there are such things, and also what role it might play in evolution and natural selection. But first, perhaps we can delve a little bit into the history of boredom and how the whole idea of boredom developed. Dr. Josepha Ross Velasco is at Harvard University. Boredom, in historical terms, has been associated with our development of language. What can you tell us about that?
Yeah, boredom is associated in part with the development of language and other creative terms. So I totally agree that boredom became famous at the very beginning of the last century, because the metaphor of boredom as a disease began to be taken at face value in the context of psychological and psychiatric research. But however, boredom has existed almost always. Starting from the beginning, I belong to the group of thinkers who claim that boredom was elected in our evolutionary race, since it played and still plays, in fact, a role in our individual and social development. Those thinkers who think that boredom meets an adaptive function in a true Darwinian sense. And it was selected at some point because it started helping individuals to cope with survival problems and keep them away from helpful environments and situations. So we can see boredom as one of that adaptive negative emotions that protect us from dangers, but highlighting our relationship with the environment and forcing us to develop a strategy to explore new opportunities. And this is in this point in which, for example, the evolution of language, of languages, per se, or of art, or myths, or of tales, and so on, can be placed.
So I want to ask to drill down a little bit on that, the adaptive quality of boredom, the suggestion that it is good for us as a species, that we are bored, that we're more effective, in our evolutionary sense because of being bored. How exactly does that work?
This is just one of that negative emotions that directly influence self-regulation by forcing the dangers, being an advantage or an opportunity for individuals. Boredom meets an adaptive role in stimulating the change that keep our interests or perhaps, if we don't suffer from boredom when we are fully adapted, forcing us to be in constant motion, we would be unable to adapt to future changes. So this is it's in this regard in which boredom may be understood as one of the driving forces in the development of cultures, of languages, and so on.
Is boredom then the sense of it the same essentially over all cultures? It is not a culturally based thing.
Yeah, of course. We can track the presence of boredom or the manifestations of boredom over history just by paying attention to the cultural manifestations over time, just from ancient times to the present. In fact, this is what I am doing currently. I am analyzing how the understanding of boredom in terms of a mental disease has gradually formed historically, paying attention to its precedents like melancholy, acedia, ennui, and so on. So we can find manifestations of boredom everywhere at every turn, from Plato to Seneca, during medieval Christianity, and so on. So, in the sense of having simply nothing to do, which is short-term boredom, or feeling satiety with the own existence, which is long-term boredom, you know.
All right. So, if I was to look at probably every parent knows the experience of being around kids who are bored, or remember their own time when they were bored with kids. There's a certain almost crushing dullness that comes at a certain age of your life when you feel as if nothing seems particularly interesting. Helen Street, you're at the Graduate School of Education at the University of Western Australia. If there is a positive element to boredom, how should teachers, educationalists, view the bored kid in class?
Okay, well, I see boredom as a signal that we are not feeling connected to doing something, whether that's internally or being connected in some way with our environment. And if we want to support young people, support children to ultimately be self-directed and intrinsically motivated and creative, then we need to help them to address their own boredom and find a way to become connected themselves. So it's about understanding that we want children to be able to take control of boredom and find a way to engage in activity. If we jump in and rescue them too easily because the bored child is sort of distressing for us because, you know, they complain and they seem unhappy and frustrated, then we're depriving them of an opportunity to find activities that support their own autonomy, that are activities that have a sense of agency about them from the child, that the child feels they have choice and control over.
So a little bit of boredom can be a good thing for kids.
Absolutely. I think it's a necessary signal for a child to understand that this is a sign that I need to be doing something different, that I'm not connected with what I'm doing, or that what I've been doing is not satisfying my basic needs for autonomy, for relationships, for building my competency. And the more that a child can learn to recognize that boredom is a signal to go and find something else to do, the more practice they can become at finding something to do that is in itself creative, that allows them to become more self-directed and motivated.
It's not possible for a child in class when they're doing a double period of whatever it is to get up and find something more interesting to do unless it's to disrupt that class. What do you make of the evidence that says that boredom begets lower exam results among students, and that results in more disengagement from class, and that feeds into higher levels of boredom, etc., that it's a downward spiral? How much is too much?
Well, absolutely, in that sense, that if you are bored with the task that you're doing in class, and then that means that you're not totally connected or engaged in that task. And then I think that that's about teachers better understanding how to support motivation in young people. So rather than necessarily trying to make something fun or easy or light, but understanding that even though the subject that the child's learning might be hard work for them or not their favourite topic, that they will be more engaged if they can give the child more of a sense of choice and control, more autonomy, if they can make sure that they feel connected to the classroom socially, and they can make sure the child understands that there is a relevancy to what they're learning and has opportunity to feel that they are making some progress. So an ongoing sense of their own competency as well. And if those three needs are satisfied, then that child is going to be more engaged in their learning and less likely to feel that frustration and boredom.
Is there formal training that gets sort of fed back into teachers as to how to play, if you like, the boredom paradox, as to how to re-stimulate or how to introduce some novelty just to shake people awake?
There's an awful lot of advice. But I don't think a lot of it is very good advice. So I feel that it sort of gets lost in translation. There's a sense amongst schools and teachers that a lack of motivation is definitely not a good thing. And there's an understanding that we need to help young people to be engaged in their learning. But what I think gets misunderstood is how we can best do that. So there's a sort of misconception that we're engaged in the things that are like fluffy or fun. But that's not really necessarily the case. It's more that we're engaged in things where we feel we have some choice and control over them, or we feel emotionally, socially safe, and where we feel we're making progress. And so handing out sort of awards and grades becomes a massive problem in schools, because although some people might feel like they're competent because they're winning those, many children then become demotivated and more frustrated and bored because they're not the winning few. We sort of constantly sort of try and rescue children by telling them what to do or giving them more tasks, and that reduces their autonomy. So that again reduces their motivation rather than a short-term rescue of compliance. And we don't spend enough time in schools helping young people to feel socially safe, to give them a sense of belonging and make them feel they can take risks and make mistakes. And so that sort of lack of understanding of how to engage children as much as teachers want to engage children, I think leads to an awful lot of unnecessary frustration and boredom in classrooms.
Okay, we're discussing the boredom paradox here at the round table. If I could go back to you, John Eastwood, from the Boredom Lab in Ontario, Canada. The old refrain was that only boring people get bored. That was one of those sort of put-down lines that parents used on their kids when they complained that they were bored. But is it true? Are some people just simply more prone to being bored than others?
Yes, it is. We do know that there are certain personality characteristics or qualities that make people at greater risk for boredom. And you could sort of think of them as cognitive factors, emotional factors, and motivational factors. So cognitively, we know individuals who have a hard time focusing and concentrating or have what's called poor executive functioning, which means they have a hard time planning and organizing and sequencing things. So people that have this kind of cognitive weakness are just going to find it more difficult to become deeply connected or engaged with material, and therefore are more likely to experience boredom.
What is the point at which, if someone feels as if they are often in their lives bored, and there's been some studies that say up to half of us say we are, quote, often bored at home or at school, and more than two-thirds of us say we are chronically bored at work, that doesn't sound very creatively inspiring. So what's the point in which people need to be aware that a little bit of boredom has become too much boredom, and it goes from being potentially a spur to creativity to being something which could be deleterious to our mental health?
I'm not sure we can exactly quantify where that point is, but as Dr. Street said earlier, boredom, I would agree. I see boredom as a signal, and then how we respond to that signal is what's critical. How we respond to that signal will determine if boredom becomes chronic and protracted, will determine if boredom leads us towards some of its negative outcomes, like addictions or the disruptive child in the classroom, or whether it might lead us to sort of double down and re-engage with the material in front of us or seek creative outlets. So it's our response to boredom that's quite critical. And I often, and I'm not the first to use this metaphor, but think of the analogy of physical pain. It's good that we have the capacity to experience pain. People who congenitally are born with conditions where they can't experience pain are actually at great risk of injuring themselves physically, because pain is that early warning signal that tells us, whoa, stop what we're doing, protect your body to stay safe. And so similarly, I think boredom is a signal that tells us that we're mentally unengaged and that we need to address that problem. That doesn't mean that we should cultivate boredom, just the same way we shouldn't cultivate pain. And so I think that when boredom becomes protracted and very oppressive, leading to a withdrawal or a disengagement from the world or other kinds of negative responses, then I think that's when boredom has become more of a problem. But I think of it less that it's boredom itself is the problem and more that it's our response to boredom. And boredom is a very aversive feeling. We don't like it, and so we want to get rid of it as quickly as we can. And many of the strategies that we adopt to get rid of that feeling end up being, damaging to ourselves, perhaps, and I would argue in the long run, often counterproductive for more deeply resolving the issue of boredom.
We live in the digital age. Whenever I'm bored, out comes my phone and I'm mucking around either on social media or perhaps on one of the silly little games. Are these things a cure to boredom, John Eastwood, or do they simply mask it or even make it worse?
Well, that's a great question. And we don't have any data to definitively speak to that question, but I would speculate that those easy, ready-to-hand electronic distractions actually end up making boredom worse in the long run. You know, there's no question when you are playing your game of Candy Crush or whatever on your smartphone that you may be not bored in that particular moment. But what's happening there is you are now passively receiving stimulation. You are having your attention directed and controlled by the electronic device, by the technology. It's exogenously being pushed around rather than us willfully directing our attention. And so Simmel, a sociologist, many years ago talked about technology and boredom colluding. And he used the metaphor of a fast-moving river. And he said that using technology is like falling into a fast-moving river that sort of carries you along, so much so that you can forget how to swim, you might say, and that then you stop figuring out what it is that you most desire and want to do, and your skills in terms of willfully directing your attention might atrophy in some way. I also think that technology just is so stimulating that it sort of is a bit like a drug, right? And so we're looking for that next bigger and more exciting hit to keep us occupied and to keep us engaged.
Okay, Josefa Ros Velasco from Harvard University. In historical sense, have we ever been so, or had so available to us, distractions that theoretically can assuage our boredom as we do now?
Distractions over history, do you mean?
Well, I'm thinking that nowadays we do have these means. I'm thinking that if you were in the Middle Ages, if you're sitting in Italy, you're tilling the field, or you're doing whatever you need to do, are we now more able to sort of try to blank and mask our boredom?
Yeah, in terms of boredom and the relationship between boredom and technology, how that affects.
Yeah.
You know, boredom is omnipresent in our modern society precisely because of the overabundance of pre-planned responses to cope with it. Perhaps pre-planned responses that doesn't exist, that don't exist in previous centuries. So it's a symptom of our context in which technology is playing a key role, of course. Because on the one hand, in the last two centuries, technology has helped to rationalize and save time, which is good. It's good to gain extra time if we know how to spend it meaningfully. Otherwise, people tend to feel confused, which started to happen in two centuries ago, more or less. And not only confused, and also bored. And on the other hand, nowadays, people, you know, are glued to their electronical devices, which are most of time no more than pre-planned entertainments with not too much space for creativity, or at least not for that kind of creativity that flourishes when we are bored and need to change the painful situation. So in this regard, technology promotes that there are lots of things to do, but we almost know all of them in advance or are get used to them very soon. And most of time, technological entertainments are not very meaningful, are not really engaging, just, a way to kill in time, which is precisely what promotes long-term boredom or chronic boredom. And this is happening especially in children and teenagers today because of social networks.
Okay, let me just put that to Dr. Helen Street. Is the use of the technology, from an educationalist point of view, do you agree with that view that you've just heard there, that it actually... far from curing boredom, in fact, makes it worse?
Well, technology is a tool in itself, so the use of technology in a creative way can be a fantastic thing. But certainly things like social media can perpetuate an inability to deal successfully with boredom. I think maybe think about it, boredom as a signal again, and think of it like being hungry. And you can go and sort of have some healthy food, which then satisfies your hunger in a long-lasting way. Or you could have a bar of chocolate, which might seem immediately like a really satisfying idea, but ultimately you're going to be sort of more nutritionally deprived and sort of have a slight hangover effect and be more hungry at the end of the day. So I think a lot of sort of social media gives you that sort of quick fast food fix, because it's extrinsically motivating. It sort of drags you along with rewards and likes and followers and awards, which is engaging, but you've got your eyes set on some sort of future prize that you want the whole time, rather than doing something more creatively. And there's plenty of sort of apps and aspects of technology that allow you to be really creative. And doing something where you're actually finding the task in itself giving you reward and feedback, because you have more agency in that, you're more involved in that. It's the task rather than some promise of somebody giving you likes or a win or a badge or a prize.
Do you believe in the theory that, and I've certainly seems to work with my kids, that things which really work when they're never bored is where there's a combination of something which interests them in their mind but also activates them physically, so it could be organized sport, but things as simple as climbing a tree or sending some kids, if you're traveling around into just a vast open place like a, you know, in the desert or something, when you travel around in there, my kids are never bored.
Well, I think it obviously depends a bit on the age of your kids. But certainly for younger kids, I think that nature offers a very deep level an opportunity for young people to find ways to engage themselves at a pace that means that they can take risks at their own pace, so that they're sort of organically and naturally learning about the environment. And so it offers opportunity for people to sort of to develop competency at a rate that works for them. So in many ways, it's sort of the outdoors and nature is set up as an ideal learning environment for children. Hence, there is a big shift in many countries, especially in the UK, to support more outdoor learning.
John Eastwood, would you agree that if you're feeling bored and it's really getting you down, get outdoors, perhaps climb a tree? Is that useful advice?
Yeah, well, you know, it's interesting. There's a little bit of research looking at the beneficial effects of spending time in nature. And it's a little unclear exactly what is happening cognitively, but there's some research to suggest that after people have spent some time in a natural environment, their attention ability actually improves. And so they're better able to concentrate and focus and engage mentally with whatever it is that they're doing. And certainly, you know, I think boredom is signaling that we are not agentically involved with the world. We're not exercising our abilities. We're not behaving on the basis of our desires and our ideas. And younger children, you know, very much develop their agency and express themselves sort of more physically. And so certainly I would think that spending time climbing trees would be a very useful way to engage a young child and stave off boredom.
All right. How much more work do you think is going to go on in this, John Eastwood? Are we at the start of a process of understanding boredom, or have we already kind of like exhausted it and in fact, we're sort of almost getting bored with the notion of boredom?
No, I don't think we're bored with the notion of boredom yet. I think, you know, philosophers and writers and theologians have been thinking about boredom for many, many years, but it's only, you know, been in the last little while that social scientists and psychologists and neuroscientists have started to think about boredom and explore it. And I would argue, and I think the, you know, the publications of different journal articles shows that we're just picking up speed, and I think there's a lot yet to be done and a lot yet for us to understand about boredom.
Okay, well, thank you for enlightening us on boredom and its paradox, its spurs to our creativity and the bits about it that make us certainly not enjoy the experience at all. Clinical psychologist John Eastwood, director of the Boredom Lab at York University in Ontario, Canada. We also heard from Dr. Josefa Ross-Valesco at Harvard University, where she works in the Department of Romance Languages and Literatures, and Dr. Helen Street from the Graduate School of Education at the University of Western Australia. Well, that's all we have time for. Thank you for listening. I'm Hugh Rimmington. Until next week.